Greetings, greetings once again to all my enemies and all my friends. Well, you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we will help you suffer through the events of this week, this past week, this coming week, the past century, and the coming millennium, and all of that. So, we did some traveling over this past week, and did some reading. Read C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man, and I'll get to all that. Because there's a lot of interesting stuff with all that. But there's also the news of the day, the news of the week. Alec Baldwin issued a tweet this past week in which he said the following. Every film set that uses guns should have a police officer on the set. Unquote. Alec Baldwin. Is Baldwin calling the cops on himself? Right? I mean, that's how I took that. You know, every criminal deep down, everyone who's committing crimes and sins deep down, because of the conscience that God put in all of us, deep down that person wants to be caught. Deep down. And I think deep down in his black little, dark little heart, that crispy black cinder of what remains of Alec Baldwin's conscience is crying out for him to be caught so that he can experience some sort of repentance and freedom that he has not known. Okay, so there's Alec Baldwin's cry for help. We open the show with a cry for help. We go from there to the politics file where New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney this past week finally conceded the election to commercial truck driver Ed Durr out there in New Jersey. That's right. You remember, Sweeney had found 12,000 votes in the middle of the night from the middle of nowhere, somewhere under Giants Stadium. Or something like that. And he was prepared to fight to the end against this truck driver who spent just a few hundred bucks on his campaign and won by default because the other side was so evil and so corrupt. And they just weren't paying attention to this one. So the truck driver won. He was prepared to fight, but now he's suddenly changed his mind. He's conceded and he says, quote, I'm not going away. I won't say what I'm doing, but I can tell you something. I'm going to be doing something, is what I'm saying, okay? But he won't say what he's going to be doing, says former New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney of the Democrat persuasion. Well, I will say what he's going to be doing. I will say, here on the Weekly Worldview, I will say. Well, I don't know exactly what he'll be doing. But I can tell you in the words of those who persuaded him to concede something about what he's been doing and what he will be doing. Hey, this Steve-O, hey, I hope you're doing great, my friend. Yes, Steve-O, we heard about the 12,000 votes that you found under Giants Stadium. Yeah, I know. Steve, listen to me, my friend. Steve, listen, if you don't wrap this thing up with a nice concession speech real quick, I'm afraid that you're going to end up way more familiar than anybody should be with the trunk of a Chevy Impala. Okay? I know, Steve. I know it's difficult. Yes. Don't worry about it, Steve. Do the right thing, and we'll make sure that you don't have to go away, if you know what I mean, Steve-O. Okay? All right. Yes, my love to the wife and the kiddos. Thank you, Steve. Unquote. So that's someone who works for someone who works for someone way above Senate President Steve Sweeney's pay grade there. It's just letting Steve-O know what needed to happen there. And so Steve will not be going away. That's right. He says he can't say what he's going to be doing, but he can tell you something. And it won't have to do with the carpet fibers in the trunk of a Chevy Impala. That's pretty much the only thing Steve knows right now. But he knows he'll be well taken care of by the benefactors in the power structure that have directed his path so far and on into the future. Now, we go from the politics file, which is relatively meaningless, to the extraordinarily important. We go to the accidental profit file. This is a new file. It was just formed accidentally by this guy. In the accidental profit file, CBS News reports that the businessman who flew to space last month with Jeff Bezos and I think the guy from Star Trek too, right? Who's the guy from Star Trek? How could I forget his name? The insurance salesman. Yeah, yeah. Now, what does he sell now? No, the travel agent salesman. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name, but you know who I'm talking about, Captain Kirk. So the businessman who flew to space with Jeff Bezos and Captain Kirk last month died in a small plane crash last week at the age of 49 years old, literally on top of the world. A billionaire who just flew to space with Captain Kirk. Captain Kirk. I mean, does it get any better than that in an earthly sense? You're on top of the world. You just paid $1 billion, $100 million for a ticket to space with Captain Kirk. You're on top of the world. And within a few weeks, you're dead. Dead. Well, what was this fella's name? His name was Glenn DeVries, a billionaire. Him and 54-year-old Thomas Fisher were killed when their small aircraft crashed in Sussex County, New Jersey, less than a month after having flown into space with Captain Kirk and being on top of the world. Before his flight with Bezos, accidental prophet Glenn DeVries said the following, quote, "I'm actually looking forward to seeing the Earth from a different perspective than I have ever had before," unquote. Said Glenn DeVries, not knowing that within just a few weeks he would be experiencing Earth from a different perspective than he ever had before. An accidental prophet. Just reminding all of us that this life is a very brief sojourn on this side of the glass through which we now view everything darkly. But the longer journey is on the other side. Whether you're going to spend that time with the Creator, the living God of the universe, or whether you're going to spend it without Him, that's going to be the vast majority of your existence. In fact, this existence will seem infinitesimal at some point. Now, speaking of this infinitesimal existence, it's not infinitesimal at all. It's extraordinarily important. The reason the entire universe was made was for us to have this existence. So I don't want to sell short the importance of this existence. I just want you to understand that this is a relatively short period of time when compared with. But let's get to the real science file, because I don't want to beat a dead horse. Researchers out at Northwestern University, which is in Chicago, which makes me wonder why it's called Northwestern University. I'm not sure what it's north and west of, like St. Louis? Not, I don't know. Atlanta? Okay, Northwestern University out in the Chicago area has developed a breakthrough new therapy to help paralyzed mice walk. And so you may wonder to yourself, is there a real driving need for paralyzed mice to walk? Well, it could lead to potentially life-altering treatments for humans. The researchers, maybe they might hate to admit it based on their worldview, but their nearly miraculous research into helping mice walk is actually all about helping humans walk. And while if you probed the education and the worldview of the researchers involved, they would have a hard time explaining to you why people are of any more import than mice. Deep down in this black little cinder that remains of what's left of their heart, they know that humans are actually more valuable than mice. They know that just by the accident of their birth into a human civilization that's been handed down to us over the generations from people who were moored somewhat more securely to reality than these particular researchers. But despite their unmooring from reality, despite their disconnectedness from the generations of the past upon whose shoulders they stand, they still have come up with a breakthrough technology that has helped mice purposely stricken with spinal cord injuries, it's helped them to walk again. Researchers injected a gel containing nanofibers that mimic spinal cord molecules and make contact with cell receptors, triggering them into movement. The new connections prompt the severed pathways between the nerve cells to grow back better, or as Joe Biden says, to build back better. This is amazing. So no fetuses were killed in the making of this gel, as far as I can tell. This is a completely artificial and non-biological material that was created in a lab to do exactly what they're trying to do with it, and it has worked, at least in a animal model. Mice in the experiment regained the ability to walk within 4 weeks of injection after having been stricken purposely with specific spinal cord injuries. Pretty amazing. The New York Post goes on to remind us that about 300,000 Americans live right now with spinal cord injury, and less than 3% ever recover even basic physical functions. And I'll put the link up. You can watch these mice. I mean, they're not walking like they're going to run a marathon, but they are moving their back legs, whereas they couldn't before. It's pretty astonishing. And so if humanity is ever allowed to move beyond the current hysterical mania over one particular virus, over which we are apparently expected to be obsessed with forever, we could go on to cure some of the greatest ills that have ever stricken mankind. We were at the doorway. We were standing at the threshold of some of the most amazing scientific breakthroughs in the annals of human history before we were stricken with this mania. And it's almost as if we couldn't handle it. It's almost as if history judged that we weren't able to do right with it, and therefore it was taken from us right at the last moment when we were about to seize upon it. We were pushed away from it purposely, as if by the hand of fate or something else similar to a concept resembling something like fate. So from there, let's go now from making mice walk again. We'll go to the new normal file, where at least some of the 17 missionaries that were kidnapped by that gang in Haiti. Does anybody remember that? Almost nobody. Because the news media doesn't report on Christian missionaries kidnapped and threatened with death. It just doesn't really fit. It's not a good ratings booster. It doesn't bring in the ratings like the COVID death count every night on the local news, every night, like clockwork. And it's not just a political agenda. It's literally a ratings game. Reporting on the COVID death count still fascinates a significant majority of the American people. And so the news media will not stop until that no longer becomes true. And I'm not sure how that no longer becomes true. It's certainly not that bigger things are going to take their attention, because that's already happened, and it hasn't changed anything. So you got 17 Americans kidnapped in Haiti, threatened with death and held hostage, and the U.S. media could care less. I have to go to the Christian Post to get any news on this story. I just remembered it earlier, I guess later in the past week, and I went to try and find information about it, and it was quite difficult. Anyway, people in the government say they've seen proof that at least some of the 16 Americans and a Haitian are still alive 3 weeks after being kidnapped. They were serving with the Ohio-based Christian Aid Ministries, which should give you some insight as to why the U.S. media could care less about them. Christian Aid is something that offends them. They're much more comfortable drinking Kool-Aid than reporting on Christian Aid anywhere in the world. The ministry, Christian Aid Ministries, based out of Ohio, says they have no way of communicating with the hostages. But somehow the State Department says they've seen proof of life. We hope they're alive, but whether they're alive or dead, they're going to be okay. because of the aforementioned Christian aid, not the Kool-Aid. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's all hard to stop. It's hard to come back on some of those. You got to cut it out with that. Makes it very difficult to focus. You know, it reminds me. Anyway, I was traveling. I've been doing some traveling. And so in the town where I was traveling, I was in a grocery store. I was in a grocery store walking through the store looking for items. And I kept hearing the grocery store clerk ringing a bell. Ringing a bell and making announcements that a donation has been made and another family has been fed for the holidays at the local military base there by the groceries. Ding! Another family fed at Camp Homestead or wherever I was. Another family fed on the military base for the holidays. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, I was in the military. The one thing you didn't have to worry about in the military was being fed. I mean, at least in the U.S. military, as far as I recall, and it was quite some time ago. But really, we're having to make donations to feed military families on the military base where they have a chow hall, where I just found that somewhat odd. And I'm wondering what's up with that. Ding! Another family fed for the holidays! Is it just, are we that desperate to feel good about ourselves that we need to donate a nickel of our checkout at the grocery to feed a family on a military base where nobody needs to be fed on a military base? Okay, trust me. Okay? But hey, you know what am I, Anyway, while I was traveling, my extremely attractive audio engineer, and our wonderful daughters experienced the perfect storm of modern-day confusion when they were confronted at a Thai restaurant, not only by a maitre d' with an extraordinarily thick Thai accent, but she was also wearing a mask, making it virtually impossible to understand what each other were talking about or wanted or needed or wanted to order. It was hilarious listening to the exchange as described by my two youngest daughters. The mask and the accent, Daddy, we didn't know what was going on. She could have been threatening us with murder for all we knew. Or she could have been asking us what type of egg rolls we preferred. There was just no way of knowing. All right, that's modern life. Anyway, I'll get back to my travels, but still, let's get back to the news of the day. Before I get to C.S. Lewis, because once I start with C.S. Lewis, that could end up taking up the whole rest of the show. But first, let's go to Astroworld, where nine people now have died from an incident at a concert by one Travis Scott. So when I first read the headline that people had been killed in a crush surge event at a Travis Scott concert, I was scanning my memory banks trying to remember if I knew an artist named Travis Scott, and all I could think of was, this sounds like a country music artist. Travis Scott. To me, that screams cowboy boots, Wranglers, and a hat. To me. And I thought, this is very unusual for people to be crushed to death at a country music concert. It just doesn't happen that often. And so, lo and behold, I found out that Travis Scott is not a country artist. No Wranglers, no boots, no hat. None of that. No twang. No bend them guitar string. None of that. Travis Scott is apparently some sort of hip-hop artist who was a part of this Astroworld, they call it a music festival. This is from the That's Entertainment file. That's Entertainment! The show, the Travis Scott concert, came to a crescendo, according to the Gateway pundit. It came to a crescendo with displays of dark imagery as Scott played on for another 30 minutes as he watched people being taken out of the crowd on gurneys and put into ambulances, allegedly. Although there's videotape of him actually looking and apparently watching. Anyway, we have a report from one of the concert goers who, by the way, folks, if your kids want to go to one of these, you have failed as a parent on some level. I'm not going to say totally, but on some level, you have failed. It's like if your kids want to go to Disney. I'm not going to say you failed utterly, but on some level, you have failed as a parent. Yes. If you have to somehow restrict your children from voluntarily consuming the pop culture, you have failed. Perhaps not utterly, and it's not too late for you, but you have failed on some significant level. You have failed your children. And you have failed God. So we have a quote from one of the concert goers who says, quote, "It just felt like we were like literally like in hell, bro," unquote. At which point his dad just puts his face in his hands and just weeps for the failure that he's been in this kid's life. By the way, I left out the profanity. There was profanity in there, too. "It just felt like we were, like, literally, like, in hell, bro." And so whenever people use the word literally, that means figuratively, just so you know. Especially when someone like this, who could not define the word literally if you ask them to. When they use that word, that means... Anyway, "It felt like we were in a concert in hell. You couldn't breathe, you couldn't see. Just imagine. Just imagine." I would have to imagine because I would want nothing to do with anything at all to do with that. But I think this is the same kid. "The whole crowd is going, help, help. And he just kept going, bro. It was scary. It was so demonic." Unquote. That's why they were there, was seeking something demonic. What they didn't expect was to get the full-throated demonic experience is what they hadn't expected. They didn't expect anyone to actually be killed or sacrificed that night. They didn't expect that summoning up the beast might actually result in something approaching human sacrifice there at the front, at the barricades. By the way, Travis Scott, who does not wear a cowboy hat nor cowboy boots nor Wranglers, as far as we know, Travis Scott, hip-hop artist, says that he would have stopped the show if he was aware that people were in danger. Well, I'm telling you, Travis, the video is a little difficult for you, my friend. This guy's been accused before of whipping the crowd up into frenzies and people being injured. Anyway, folks, I made reference to the pop culture. And as death has become entertainment in the broadcast media, death has increasingly become one of the sacraments of the circuses of our time. Death. So the artists on the stages, they sing about it. Or I don't know if they even sing anymore. I don't know what you call it. They talk about it in a rhythmic sense, sometimes rhyming even, perhaps. Is that what hip-hop is? Anyway, they talk about it. They obsess about it. They have pictures that are all skulls and bones and as if death is something entertaining. I'm sure if you bought a Travis Scott t-shirt at the merch counter, it would make some reference directly or indirectly to death as if it were something fun and entertaining. And so the kids are all right. They were just having fun is what it was. Travis is a fine fellow. He was just entertaining them and having fun. From there, we go, if that's possible, to decline and fall any further, which it is. We go into the decline and fall file, where a new poll by Arizona Christian University finds that about 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds now identify as homos. I'm sorry, LGBTQ. I prefer homos just because it's easier to say. And it definitely expresses more of what I mean. So, folks, did you get that? About 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds identify as queers, as perverts, as homosexual, sodomite, pervs. About 40%. Or at least 40% want you to think they are. Which, you know, I would guess half of those would actually be grossed out if you put them in a position where they had to actually go through with something like that. I mean, I would hope so. Or, you know, if you showed it to them, they would probably actually be repulsed. But 40% of them think you want to hear that, which that's disturbing in and of itself. In the same poll, about 25% of Americans aged 25 to 37, also identify as homos. So if they're not actually homos, they want people to think that they're homos, which, all right. That's why it's the decline and fall. A previous poll by Gallup, by the way, back in 2017, found that about 6% of adults identified as homosexual. 6% in 2017. Fast forward to 2021. Fast forward indeed. Fast backwards. Fast decline. Fast rapid descent. A rapid descent into 1,000 years of darkness. Because if that's what people want people to think about them, I mean, even if they're not actually that, but if they want you to think that they're good with that or okay with that, or maybe they are that or whatever's going on, it's definitely not a good sign. Speaking of signs, I was at the airport because I was traveling and I didn't want to walk the whole way, so I decided to take an airplane. And I was in an airport in any American city, USA. I'm not going to say what city it was because I don't want to embarrass the poor, hapless inhabitants of that city by associating them with what I'm about to report. So I'm in an airport and the sign reads this, quote, "Please remember the basic code of conduct that is in the heart of the insert any American city, USA, promise. Remember the basic code at the heart of our city's promise," is what the sign reads, okay? And then here's what it says. Bullet number one, "I promise to act as if I carry the coronavirus." That's bullet number one. "I promise to act as if I carry the coronavirus." Bullet number two, "I promise to maintain social distancing of at least 6 feet." At least 6 feet. Bullet number three, "I promise to wear a face covering, to wash my hands, and to use hand sanitizer." Bullet number four, "I promise to buy from local businesses that also make this promise." Should have been "these promises," but that's okay. We're certainly not gonna suffer the criticism of anyone's grammar here, because this is way bigger than all that. Bullet number five, "I promise to practice patience, compassion, empathy, connection, respect, and love." And finally, bullet number six, "I promise to kill all those who do not promise just like me."
Yeah.
right. All right. Wow. He's going to hold that one. All right. All right. So I will admit that I made that last bullet up. I mean, for the moment, that bullet is not there yet. But the implication is certainly there. Anyway, while I'm on the plane, since I'm in a traveling mode here, got my walking shoes on, so to speak. So I'm on the airplane, and it was American Airlines, by the way. I will say that it was American Airlines. And the male stewardess, while doing the oxygen mask demonstration, felt it necessary to point out that he was wearing a face covering during the oxygen mask demonstration, strictly for safety purposes. I'm wearing this face covering for safety purposes. If the oxygen mask actually falls, we hope that you'll understand you're supposed to remove your face covering before putting on the... I'm just keeping this on for safety purposes during the demonstration. I just want to make that clear. Which, I mean, this is indicative of the fact that what we are all experiencing is degrading our respect for one another's intelligence. Because we all intuitively know that if you're stupid enough to go along with all this, you're probably actually stupid. Which really isn't the case. Most people are just going along to try to get along, and they don't understand that they're implying to everyone else that they're stupid. And that now we're all looking at each other as if we're morons. Which is really sad and pathetic and actually dangerous. It's actually dangerous for people to continually build up a reservoir of disrespect for one another. But we subconsciously are doing that to one another by simply acting stupidly day after day after day, over and over and over. Submitting to what is basically a Marxist humiliation exercise daily implies that you're an idiot. And unfortunately, it implies that to everyone around you. Now, speaking of idiocy, reason number 1,223 to get or keep your children out of the government schools. A teacher out in L.A. named Joshua Moreno decided to stop giving out scores of A through F because he says he was literally quite inequitable. It was inequitable, is what it was. He's a teacher at Alhambra High School. He's an English teacher. I teach English at Alhambra. But I no longer give students any homework. And I have removed behavior, deadlines, and how much they work from the equation of their grades. Because, you know, it was so inequitable. So this is what's happening in the public schools. Teachers are being allowed to simply discard the grading system. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, because traditional grading has often been used to justify and provide unequal educational opportunities based on a student's race or class. I'm sorry. That should have been a Japanese accent. That was a letter sent by Yoshimoto, a senior executive director at the Division of Instruction to Prince. I'm sorry for an inaccurate, racially offensive, whatever that was. I apologize to my Japanese speaking audience for not appropriately appropriating their accent. Now that brings, so the abolition of the letter grading system, that appropriately segues me into, as his extremely attractive audio engineer, her side is actually ripped open. We're going to have a surgeon come in and stitch that up. I apologize for that. But that brings me, ladies and gentlemen, to The Abolition of Man, which is a book written by C.S. Lewis that I read on my trip as I traveled with my face mask on for safety purposes. The Abolition of Man, I read it twice. I had to read it twice. Why? Because it's very difficult for a modern brain like mine to comprehend literature. Even literature written less than a century ago is far too sophisticated for me to understand in one reading. I'll just admit it. The first time I read it, I couldn't follow it. It was simply too smart for me. So I had to read it again. And I highly recommend to everyone in the audience, get a copy of The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis and read it at least twice, because it's far more prophetic than anything that Orwell or Huxley or any of the other secular dystopians have written. Far more prophetic. The first chapter, it's difficult to follow because he's criticizing textbooks in the schools of Britain nearly 100 years ago. In fact, some of them starting about 100 years ago. C.S. Lewis is sounding the alarm about what's happening in the public schools about 100 years ago. And he uses the examples of the airplane, wireless communications, and contraceptives as the most obvious and latest means by which man is overcoming nature, which is the theme. One of the themes of the book is man's desire to conquer and master nature and make it his slave. Man's conquest of nature. And he uses this device of airplanes, wireless, and the contraceptives as just the latest means by which man is overcoming nature, conquering nature. With the conquest of nature and the establishment of so-called science and so-called experts, right, as preeminent over old-fashioned notions like religion and spirituality. Basically, one of the themes of the book is that this conquest of nature, this establishment of science and experts, was one of the driving forces of the secular world in the 20th century. At least that's what was the point of getting educated. The point of getting educated, as it was sold to our grandfathers, was that education would overthrow God. I mean, they didn't put it in so many words, but the way education was sold to those who went and got it, in the university class at least, were sold the idea that that was the ultimate point of getting an education. That education was going to free you from morality and these quaint, outdated, antiquated ideas about morality and right and wrong and duty and justice and honor and beauty and all of those things. That was what was sold to your grandfather and mine, was that education was going to free them from God. Now, the text of the book, the text of The Abolition of Man, was actually delivered as lectures, live, on stage, in front of God and everybody, February 1943. And so, keep in mind, February 1943, the tide had turned in World War II. And it was really just a matter of time and perseverance to see that the Allies and what we thought of as Western civilization, if we could just outlast the Nazis and the Axis, it was just a matter of time and perseverance until we would survive the onslaught, right? The West, the Allies, we would survive the onslaught. The onslaught of what? Adolf Hitler, Tojo, Mussolini. Well, you could say that. Those are the proper names. But really what we were trying to survive in World War II was the onslaught of the bastard children to which we had given birth. The onslaught of the bastard children to whom we, as Western civilization, had given birth. That bastard child, those bastard children, We'll call it a bastard child to keep it simple, being what I'm going to call atheistic communism. Sometimes, and some people, they call it fascism, sometimes Nazism, sometimes communism or socialism, or even the latest, which is a softer and much friendlier term, they call it state capitalism. State capitalism, as a described by the Chinese. Uh-huh, and a propagandist there. State capitalism, yes. That's the latest. I call it atheistic communism. I call it atheistic communism in order to set it as in clear opposition as I can to what I will call godly communism. So we got atheistic communism set in distinct opposition to godly communism. Godly communism, by the way, is what we call the family, as ordained by God. The family is an institution that God gave us in which people can have things in common and not consider it robbery. Stop and think about that for a minute. Think about your own family, right? We can have things in common and not consider it robbery. It's an earthly reflection of the relationship within the Trinity, because we were created in the image and likeness of God. So the family is an earthly reflection of the relationship within the Trinity. We can hold things all in common and not consider it robbery. But that's a whole nother story, a whole nother show, a whole nother sermon, whatever you want to call it, altogether. That's something else. So let me come back to atheistic communism and fascism. What was happening at the end of World War II? C.S. Lewis, without necessarily purposing to do so, I feel, in his book, The Abolition of Man, he described the first two bastard children to rise up in hatred and try to kill the parents who had raised them. That's communism and fascism, right? These are the first two bastard children of Western civilization that rose up in hatred against the parents who had raised them and wanted to murder their parents. And Lewis was warning us, I believe, in The Abolition of Man about the rise of the third bastard child coming. A bastard child in the book who's not given a name, but who I'm afraid, it appears, has actually inherited the world, as we were warned by C.S. Lewis in the book, The Abolition of Man. And that child is doing with the world exactly what Lewis expected he would do with it. And we can see it all around us. Sometimes I feel it closing in on us. I feel it closing in on myself and my family. And it's nothing good. There's nothing good in it, what that bastard child is doing with the world today, as predicted by C.S. Lewis. So before the surrender of the Axis powers, Lewis had already turned to the next war, which was not the Cold War, by the way. The Cold War, I believe, will be found to have been mostly a sham. Mostly a scam and a sham carried off by the winners of World War II, mostly for money, as far as most of them knew at the time. But in the perpetration of the Cold War, just as the necessary prosecution of World War II had been, our attention was taken away from what was really going on. And so I'll ask you what was going on. And then I'll come back and I'll tell you what C.S. Lewis told us was actually going on. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, and what was going on? What's going on? So I feel like I should interrupt this and tell a joke, but then I feel like no. And then I realized that if I were smarter and more gifted, I would write all this down and publish it, which I'll try to do that. But I'm just not as smart as C.S. Lewis. 100 years on, and I'm not able to do what he did. I'm embarrassed to say, but that's the fact. But I'll try to write all this down. Because, people have written books about books that C.S. Lewis has written, which shows how smart he was in comparison to us, that we're writing books about books that he wrote. Anyway, what was really going on at the end of World War II, and on into the Cold War, as a matter of fact, was not the Cold War. That was window dressing. What was really going on was the breathing of new life into the corpse of the defeated foe, which we find, to our surprise, not to have been fascism, not Nazism, and not communism, as we were told was the enemy in the Cold War, but in reality, the one vanquished by the so-called Allies was what I will call Christendom. And what Lewis associates in his book, The Abolition of Man, with the ancient Chinese nomenclature of the Tao. And what anyone three generations prior to us would have simply called, with some measure of reverence, by the way, Western civilization. So it wasn't the Nazis or the fascists or the communists who we had defeated. It was actually the West that lied dead on the floor at the end of World War II and as we went into the Cold War. It was the West dead on the floor. And there were men standing above her, looking down at her dead body on the floor, desiring to breathe new life into her. And this new life that these academics, basically, directing the Allied leadership, this new life that they would breathe into her was a gale that Lewis had already identified. He had already smelt it in the air, so to speak. And The Abolition of Man, that series of lectures that he gave, The Abolition of Man was Lewis's warning sign, nailed to the doorpost of history for anyone caring to look and to notice and to see and to perceive. What was in the air that Lewis smelt was a new reality and ultimately a new humanity, defined not by Christianity or God or religion or the Tao or Western civilization or whatever you want to call it, that common understanding of what is good and right and decent and beautiful that we all thought we understood together, or at least that I thought we all understood together. What C.S. Lewis knew we all understood together before. What that new reality was going to be was ultimately a humanity defined by the appetites of the academics guiding the Allied powers after the Second World War into the Cold War. Humanity would be defined by the appetites of these academics alone, apart from objective morality. And not just the appetites of man in general, by the way. Not just those appetites. And herein lies the diabolical nature of the crime that these men were committing. It's not just the general appetites of man that they would rely on to inform this new life that they would imbue into what was formerly called Western civilization or Christendom or the Tao or just that common understanding that we all had. It wasn't just the general appetites of man, but the appetites of these particular men, these same mid-century secular leftists who at a moment in time stood atop a smoldering world nearly completely destroyed, who by the end of the war realized that they had actually captured the culture, that they had in fact finally killed her. And now they could remake her, both on the east side and on the west side of the Iron Curtain, by the way. Both sides against the middle, so to speak. And so these academics stood on top of a burning, smoldering world, looking down at Christendom, whom they had slain, finally. And unlike history's indispensable man, George Washington, the academics animating the so-called allies would choose not to submit their authority in humility to God, like George Washington had. They would choose to do something different. Because in the 6.66 generations between George Washington and Harry Truman, humility had been thoroughly replaced by humanism. There was humanism in George Washington's day, but it had not thoroughly eclipsed humility and godliness. But by Harry Truman, it had. And this time, it would be humans, men with power, specific men with power, apart from any allegiance to any godliness, who would remake the world in their image. They'd been at it for half a century before the end of World War II, before we got into the Cold War. They'd been at it already. How do we know? Because C.S. Lewis was warning us about it. And so what we've been sold as our greatest generation and her greatest victory, World War II, what we've been sold as a great victory and a great generation is on the verge of cementing its place in actual history as the fountainhead of our ultimate downfall. The ultimate destruction of the West, of Christendom, of the Tao, of that common wisdom and that common understanding of what was good that was handed down to us. All of that, the death of all of that, is going to be laid at the feet of what we've been sold as our greatest generation and her greatest victory. World War II, the Cold War, all of that is not anything of what we thought. It's actually going to be recognized by actual history as the fountainhead of our ultimate downfall. Having brought humanity by the mid-20th century, by tolerance of leftism, by the way, into the desperate position of having to fight for our lives against the rise of the secular rule that we had allowed room for. We, those who were Christians, those who obeyed that common understanding of decency and honor and right and wrong and good and bad, those of that we had made place for it. We had allowed room for it, I should say, by tolerance of leftism. And because of that, because we ended up fighting for our lives over it, our grandfathers were basically lured into a Faustian bargain and persuaded to sacrifice that which made us great for that which would merely sustain our existence. In essence, our grandfathers traded Christendom for a bowl of stew. And then our parents, and now we, and now our children have been handed that slop and told to like it. But it's become bitter in the stomachs of the children. I'm sorry. It's become bitter in the stomachs of the children. And as the vomit comes up, it comes out like a whirlwind to sweep away Even that mere existence that was bargained for by Grandpa and whom our winking grandfather folded over like a worn-out dollar bill and shoved into our pocket with a grin of a certain type. So the essence of the book, to me, The Abolition of Man, the essence of the book is the pursuit of the conquest of man over nature as it really exists, which is the pursuit of the conquest of God by man. That's what it's really about. And in the end, that turns out, to the chagrin of the conquerors, to be merely the conquest of men by other men. The latter having convinced the former that the conquest would make them free, but neither being able to carry off what needs come when the conquest is complete, making the latter more foolish than the former, but in the end, both having been defeated. And in my mind, that's the threshold upon which we stand right now. The abolition of man. The ultimate conquest of man by himself, and then his inability to carry it forward outside of what I will call Christendom. That's the precarious point in history at which we stand right now. And so, anyway, I'll try to write all this down because I wish I could write like C.S. Lewis. I cannot. And I imagine if the speeches were recorded and I could go back and listen, I would have to face the sad reality that I cannot speak like him either. But I can speak what I can speak to my generation, which is I highly recommend you read this book twice, at least twice, and take from it the warning that was intended. Because if we do that, there is a possibility that we can pull our children back from the precipice. There is that possibility. Because God is who he is, and because he sits where he sits, and because he's created us in his image and his likeness, all is not lost. All is not lost. We all have the opportunity to come to repentance and to try to rescue our neighbors from the impending calamity. And so just as I thought, just as I suspected would happen, my analysis of C.S. Lewis, The Abolition of Man, has indeed taken up the entire rest of the show, as well it should. And so should I end with a joke or should I end with something serious? How about something serious and then something that you might find humorous, possibly? From the Justice System File, the Los Angeles Police Department has issued a notification, a community alert they call it, offering guidance on what to do should you come face to face with a bandit, a robber, a thug, a bandito. Yes, here's what the community alert notification from the LAPD advises. Quote, if you are being robbed, do not resist. Cooperate and comply. Be a good witness. Unquote. So on the heels of C.S. Lewis, this is illustrative, no? Is it not? If you're being robbed, do not resist. I will resist. I will not cooperate. I will not comply with the robbery of my civilization from my children. I will not stand by and cooperate. Instead, I'll do what the LAPD advises, and I will be a good witness, as Dr. Lewis was. Although I don't know if he was a doctor. I don't know if he ever condescended to a physical degree. Anyway. So I was watching television in a strange town where it was, if you're in a strange town, you watch television, you'll see things that you don't see in your town. And what I saw was an advertisement for Tide Pods. He said to his extremely attractive audio engineer, do you use Tide Pods?
What's that?
Tide Pods? It's for the laundry. It's a pod that you throw in the laundry You don't use those? That's probably why we don't see commercials for them. So anyway, I saw a commercial for Tide Pods, and now Tide Pods have childproof packaging that they advertise on TV that toddlers cannot get into the Tide Pods. And so I just want to let the folks at Tide know that it's not the toddlers or the infants that we're worried about getting into the Tide Pods. It's the teenagers watching the YouTube and the... But then I remembered, isn't the Tide Pod Challenge, like, isn't that, like, 2018? There was the Tide Pod Challenge. It was quite the controversy. Look, my extremely attractive audio engineer is not even aware of it. Proving that she's probably a better person than you and I. Because she's... But anyway, wasn't that, like, 3 or 4 years ago now? Anyway, Tide, it wasn't the toddlers we were worried about eating the Tide Pods. It was the YouTube... generation. Anyway, that's it, folks, for the Weekly Worldview. I want to thank my friends at Real Science Radio and at American Right to Life, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview studio. Should the Lord tarry, we will return next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.